Well, I'm very happy to be here. I'm here with philosopher Cadel Last, and I'm here with... How would you describe yourself, Carl? We could speak about you as a researcher, associate professor of media in the School of Arts and Creative Industries at the University of East London. And you're a thinker, and in fact, you coined the term hyperhumanism. I believe you refer to yourself as a prime theorist in relation to that, so that's probably enough for now. Cadel is the founder of Philosophy Portal, with an interdisciplinary background in fields of evolutionary anthropology, psychoanalysis, complexity science, and big history, and a lot more too. Listeners to Voicecraft will be familiar with both of you guys over the last number of years. Bit of a gap between recordings with Carl, but nevertheless, very much looking forward to this. We're meeting in the context of the terms and the relationship between hyperhumanism and transhumanism. So of course, what's the meaning of humanism in relation to theirs? Super interesting. What is at stake in these terms? What's at stake in the meaning of humanity? You know, what matters to us? All of this. We're also meeting in the context of a Voicecraft expedition into the meaning and relationship between humanity, technology, and nature. Of course, transhumanism and hyperhumanism both being closely associated with humanity's relationship to technology. So there's an awful lot here. What I would like to do is to share each how we're relating to these notions and then move into dialoguing a bit about what's at stake for us in this context. Without saying any more on my part yet, perhaps I might move it over to yourself, Cadel. Just ask you to reflect a little bit about how you relate to these notions and what they mean for you, perhaps your history with them. That might serve us well as we move into this dialogue.
Yeah, and great to be here. I've been collaborating with Carl on this topic for the last year, and interested in the direction he's taking it. I've always been interested in the way Carl seems to combine the hyper-technological and at the same time sort of the shamanic and the ancient and the primal. And there's something there in that interconnection, which I've always appreciated in his work, and very interested to see what comes out of this conversation. So I have a long background with this concept. Hopefully I'll be able to complexify the picture of how I understand transhumanism so as to rid it of what I would consider to be, let's say, a negative moral charge against it, because I've always approached it scientifically in my work. In other words, I've never approached it through a moral good or bad lens. I'm just interested in transhumanism as a ideological symptom of potentially an evolutionary force, which is objective. So let me tell you about why that idea resonates for me, and what legitimizes that point of view. So it all goes back to a thought experiment that I had when I was studying evolution. So I studied the evolution of primates and human beings. And I was basically running a thought experiment on deep time, which is that if, given what we know about the theory of evolution, you can reasonably predict that almost any biological life form will more or less look like it does now if you project it, say, 5 or 10 million years into the future. What that means is that a chimpanzee, a lion, or a dolphin, for example, projected out 5, 10 million years, will not actually be still lions, chimpanzees, or dolphins, but they'll look something like a lion, a chimpanzee, or a dolphin. Just in the same way as if you go back in time 5 million years, you won't find chimpanzees, but you'll find something that looks like the ancestor of a chimpanzee. However, if you use that same logic to the nature of the human civilization, because I want to emphasize that when we talk about human beings, really what we have to talk about is the nature of human civilization itself. When you think about human beings on that time scale, things just don't seem to make any sense. What I mean by that is when we talk about large-scale human civilization, ancient Egypt, for example, or ancient Rome, for example, or ancient China, for example. These are massive social entities which only lasted for thousands of years. They don't last for millions of years. In other words, human civilizations don't seem to basically contradict evolutionary time in terms of changing over millions of years. Our civilizations change over thousands of years, historically speaking, and increasingly with the acceleration of technology, and with technology being the unique different factor in the equation when considering biological evolutionary change, technology accelerates things so quickly that when you think about something like the United States or modern nation states, will these things or could these things exist 10,000 years into the future, let alone 10 million years into the future? It seems unlikely. It seems improbable. It seems like something in the nature of what we are contradicts deep time due to just the acceleration of the phenomena. So it basically presents us with this idea that what has emerged, and this is sort of what I develop in my thesis, Global Brain Singularity, is we have to think about the cosmic evolutionary force as us participating in something which is beyond what we've normally conceived of as the evolutionary process. So we have chemistry, we have biology, we have culture, and all of these things have opened up different evolutions. So we have physical chemical evolution, then you have biochemical evolution, and then you have biocultural evolution. And each of these forms of evolution, well, one, they have different selection pressures, but these different selection pressures seem to operate on different timescales. Specifically with cultural transmission of information, cultural transmission of information, crucially, does not involve the death of the organism, as it does with biochemical evolution. In order for change to occur in biochemical evolution, it requires the death of the organism. So there's something with culture, which in some sense is immortal in a certain dimension, because it doesn't require the death of the organism in order to install change. You might have subjective pain in cultural transmission, like learning something new is difficult, right? But you don't have to literally die. It can be a metaphorical death. Now, the idea and the thesis I develop is that we human beings, and this is well established in anthropology, this is not a wild speculation at all, that human beings are understood as agents of biocultural evolution, and that human beings as agents of biocultural evolution might be a bridge. This is the speculative hypothetical dimension. The human beings might be a bridge towards a different type of evolution. And that different type of evolution is an evolution I call technocultural. So we might be in between a space of biocultural and technocultural evolution. And with that theory, I basically make two predictions. So, and so this is not my ideology, it's just, and I don't care about this theory, like personally, like I'm not trying to identify with it. I'm just saying, if this theory is true, this is what I would predict would happen. So the two things that I would predict would happen is we would have a reduction of the reproduction rate of biology. We would have declining reproduction, because we would shift energy from biocultural evolution, the actual like cultural maintenance of biological reproduction, which I think traditionally was handled by religion. And we would shift that energy into technocultural evolution, meaning that we would start to more dedicate our time and energy to reproducing, let's say, spirit children through the ethos of technology or something like that, right? Now, the second prediction would be that we would have an increased biotech replacement rate, meaning when biology fails, we would increasingly replace it with something technological. So like the example I always give for this is that my granddad had a 15 extra years of life because he basically had a mechanical heart. He had five heart attacks. And over the span of those five heart attacks, he had a pacemaker. And what's a pacemaker? Well, it's a technology that's keeping his heart alive artificially. So the prediction would be, again, less energy dedicated to biological reproduction and increased replacement rate of technology with failed biology. right? And so is that, so that like basically those are the predictions of the theory. Will that continue to happen? And I view basically the ideologies, like the different humanisms, like whatever different humanism you want to pick. I view all of those different humanisms, long story short, through the lens of this theory. Like, because all of these different ideologies, whether they're humanism, whether they're transhumanism, whether they're metahumanism, whether they're hyperhuman, whatever the humanism, these are different ways human beings are trying to interpret a major evolutionary transition that's underway. And we don't, and here's the most honest statement. We do, and I could go into detail about the specific ideology of transhumanism, because that's, I studied that in great detail. But we, in all honesty, we don't know what's happening. And we, and there's no way, philosophically, there's no way to know what's going to exist 100 years from now, or 10,000 years from now, or 10 million years from now, from our evolutionary process. And that's distinct, totally distinct from, let's say, physico-chemical evolution. Because with physico-chemical evolution, we kind of do know what Mars is going to be doing in 3 million years. We kind of do know what the Andromeda galaxy will be doing in 3 million years. We have no clue whatever our evolutionary process is doing will be up to in 3 million years. And that's the fantastic mystery of it all.
Yeah, thank you for that, Cadell. There's so much there, and it's a great introduction. Carl, if we move over to you now, just for this initial part, just so you can share a little bit how you relate to these terms, and obviously hyperhumanism in particular, that would be awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tim, and thanks, Cadell, for a fantastic overview there of the post-biological era that we are supposedly going into. And you know, I'm fascinated by, you know, this idea that we can't predict the future, but I firmly believe we can invent it. And that's really my sort of hope, that, you know, that humans are extremely bizarre things, as Cadell's pointed out. We sort of stand apart from the rest of creation, if you like. And maybe a good place to start is to go through those different types of humanism. So humanism, I think, started us off and sort of made a categorical error by sort of saying we are the apex creature, we are the top of the pie in terms of the food chain and intelligence and all the rest of it. But I think that if we look at how that's panned out, and how we seem to have destroyed almost every other species, and how we are witnessing, you know, so many forms of crises, most of which are caused by us. And then we look underneath the ground and see the mycelium just busily working away and sharing when they're in abundance, and doing the exact opposite of what we're doing in our capitalist sort of rigged systems. I think that the intelligence isn't with us, even though we have the potential to maybe go post-biological, and maybe we are the bridge in between this sort of biological and post-biological era. I think that we still need to look back to these, as Cadell rightly says, to look back to these humanisms, look at them through as a lens through where we may go. So humanism, I think, you know, interesting, but error, full of error. Then post-humanism is like the human project's already done. And you can see a lot of evidence that people firmly believe that. People already believe that they're a waste of space because of AI coming in, and they think AI is this sentient other, when in fact there is no AI. It's literally just machine learning, which we have invented. And machine learning certainly is not sentient, and it does a fantastic mimicry of sentience. And I think that that's why people are starting to lose their minds and starting to feel redundant. I mean, even if I'm talking to my students and showing them these are the things that are now possible, they don't actually want to hear it. And you can see even in the Gen Zers, there's this return to a sort of Luddite perspective where they really don't want, they're going down a dumb phone route. They're returning to old media, to old fashions. Like, even like if you look at CDs versus vinyl, vinyl's coming back. And I seriously think, you know, I don't know if we're going to have enough electricity for the next 5 years, considering the state of the world, compared with this really sort of absurdity of Neuralink and the idea that everyone's going to want to install their mobile phones directly in their brains. I just don't see that happening. I think there's a huge backlash already underway with technology as it is now in terms of social media. And people, like we talked to Ebert about this idea of, you know, I even saw an advert on the underground in the tube yesterday, which was, you know, get away from it all. Come and stay in the woods. Here you can come and there's no internet. And you're paying a premium to not have technology. So I think it's that kind of trend that I'm seeing, that you know, the people that are creating these huge corporations, these big tech corporations, you know, don't let their kids anywhere near the creations because they know how they've been designed. So I think it's super interesting that on the one hand, we're not even human without technology. I think transhumanism is firmly already here. I think that, you know, that's kind of like the standard. I think that, you know, as Cadell says, his dad survived X amount of years longer because he became a cyborg, essentially. People with ear, you know, ear who are deaf and they have cochlear implants, they're cyborgs. So it's a standard thing now, I think, that we're all cyborgs because if we've got mobile phones. How many people are surviving without mobile phones? So it's kind of forced upon us. So I think transhumanism, we are cyborgs. I think there's no doubt that we are human with technology. And hyperhumanism is certainly not a Luddite approach. It's very much embracing technology, but it's using technology in a very hyperhuman way. And I'll get to what hyperhumanism is. But Cadell's already mentioned another one, metahumanism. So metahumanism, if you look at their manifesto, it's a very interesting one. It's very much about embodiment. It's very much about talking to the other kingdoms. So let's try and understand what we are. We seem like we're the odd one out, right? In terms of, as Cadell's already said, we are this extraordinarily strange creature where we can't predict, let alone 3 million years. We can't predict 5 years into the future. And I think that's what makes it such a fantastic lottery win to be human, because we're so bizarre. In that sense, we can't computer model ourselves. We just don't know what's going to happen to us as a whole. And I think there probably will be a splitting off into people that just go back to living in the forest with no internet, living in like hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But I think maybe, as Graham Hancock says, is that the indigenous will survive what's coming. Because, you know, we're in very strange times where we can't really... You know, it doesn't matter how rich you are, you can't have that peace of mind that you're going to have a future. It's as simple as that. So metahumanism, interesting. Let's speak to the other species. Let's find out what the humans are from their perspective, because I don't think we know what we are. And I think that's, ironically, what AI and machine learning will enable is this. And we're already seeing it. We're already seeing that AI is enabling us to unlock the languages of other species, just as a byproduct of LLMs and language being at the core of how we're accessing this intelligence. Obviously, everything is speaking. Everything is in a form of language. And now we know that birds give their young names. Now we understand that there is signaling between plants. There is communication between the trees. So, you know, everything is alive. And unfortunately, in order to live, you have to kill. Whether it's killing plants or killing animals, we are here in this, you know, dog eats dog, you know, kind of scenario. So I think hyperhumanism is really, a call to arms. It's a resistance. It's like, let's create a North Star, which we may never reach. But what I'm really interested in, and Cadell's pointed this out, is that I think the hyperhumans were already in the past. If we think about the Sherpas that are climbing up the hill with all of your luggage, as you're like struggling to get up Mount Everest or whatever it is, you know, it's like we already see examples of these hyperhumans in history, but there are hyperhumans to come. And I think that hyperhumanism is just essentially this idea that we have untapped human potential that's been atrophied because of technology, because of poorly designed technocentric technologies that have zombified us and taken away our humanity. when we can design technology better, and we can even design technology to undo the damage caused by technology. And I think that's the message of hyperhumanism. Let's design technology to be more like a scaffold that gives you a skill, but then actually you develop that skill for yourself. Much like stabilizers on your bike, you may have used stabilizers for a few months, but then you remove the stabilizers. You've got the skill, you develop the skill, you become an expert cyclist without any extra technology required. So it's a doing away with the dependence. It's understanding that you're a big boy now, that you are able to create your own internal technologies, that of course technology is essential to what it means to be human, but let's make sure that we design it in a way that's fruitful for the human project, that enables us to access those 50 senses rather than, you know, if you think about virtual reality is sensory deprivation, because all we're seeing generally is vision and audio. So the rest of your senses are atrophying if you're living in chat VR, which a lot of people are, because they're scared of reality as it stands.
Yeah, beautiful. Thanks, Carl. Yeah, thanks, guys. So I was thinking about how to take this forward. And what I'd like to do is drop into a mode of contemplation, see if I can presence a few things, see if I can cohere them a bit, and I'll try and touch on some tensions, some distinctions, try and presence a real context of grappling and relating with lack, and a real process of tuning into value and what matters. And for those listening, part of the reason I'm doing this, and if this is the first time that you are tuning in the Voicecraft context, we are seeking to engage in many things, but one aspect of it is a mode of contemplation together. And it can involve, and often does need to, drop into an atmosphere of uncertainty and a real relating with the question on the very pulse of the relation between knowing and deep uncertainty. And in that way, you can find a real radical edge of intrigue, of relevance. And so we've now laid out a bit of a foundation. In terms of how I have been relating with these notions, and I'm curious what you guys make of this, in a very limited sense, very basic sense, we can think about transhuman as, just taking the word of it, as a moving beyond the future. We can think about, I think, hyperhumanism as well as transhumanism, and if I could just name, for want of a better word, you mentioned Ludditism, Carl, as sort of this rejection of technology and a kind of potentially a looking back. I was thinking of that in terms of a kind of an archaeohumanism, which in a vulgar form could be a kind of Ludditism as just a rejection, right? But on the other hand, perhaps to speak to it maybe more charitably, this deep-seated desire to recover something that has been lost, that might have been known in the past, that our humanity might be back there somewhere. Now, I do want to articulate in this position, to distinguish it in this case from hyperhumanism, that there's still a certain rejection of the discovery of the future in that kind of archaeohumanism perspective. And so we can look at it towards one way of a pole and hyperhumanism perhaps toward another way. But of course, there are so many humanisms. You're talking to Zach Stein, Mark Gaffney at some point in the future. They're talking about cosmoerotic humanism, where fundamentally they're considering what we are here together as well, which is this relationship that I think Cadell spoke to very well, which could be framed on the one hand. We could think about evolution, and Cadell's articulating the various types of, some people would use the language of emergence for sure, but certainly that there's a new sort of event in reality, chemistry, biology, moving into culture, and evolution is playing out in this different context. and we can't understand it in precisely the same way. So we have evolution and then a kind of perennialism, where we might be thinking there in terms of that which remains, at least in some degree, in continuity, in coherence. When evolution, obviously, we're relating with change. And so what comes to mind very much for me in relation is this relationship between discovery and recovery. If we take transhumanism, it might be seen as the view we're actually, rather than thinking in any sense that the future of humanity is to be recaptured or recovered from the past, actually we're looking to move so radically into the future so as to become something totally other. And in its most sort of vulgar version, which I think is more or less how it comes across, it's a kind of very much disembodied. The image I kind of get is something like a corpse moving, holding its own head off to the side, willing to just throw that head into the machine, as though the head was containing all the vitality. There it goes into the machine, even though the body's doing the throwing. It's not even aware of it. And Cadell, you can speak to this, you know, very well from many different perspectives. And so there's a real insistence in the transhumanism of this becoming. We must become something other, meanings to be found in the future. Really, fuck the past and we'll efface ourselves in order to get there. And there's no real thought that in that becoming something other, we could recover a meaning of human being, that we're needing to reconnect with the history of our evolution. It's a kind of blank slateism in it. And that always concerns me because psychologically speaking, psychoanalytically speaking, it seems profoundly disintegrated. And at this point, I wonder what it is to relate with the beings, what it is to relate with the being of that activity of transhumanism. And you've spoken to it so well, Carl, the various ways that people naturally are coming to reject this. And we can point out many aspects of society which seem to be so deeply in violation of what it is, what it means to be as such, what it is, we can say, to be a human being. So I've said a number of things. There's different ways I'm relating to this, to these notions. I think above all for me, what's at stake is how we actually come to relate with the question of humanity, what it is to actually meet each other and drop into the process of being with the question itself, and in being with the question, in really participating in exchange, that we can participate both in discovery as well as recovery. And so there's something about who we bring in ourselves to this discourse, to life, which seems to be deeply necessary and is utterly at stake in the very possibility for coming to relate in a adaptive and healthy way with the future. So thank you for allowing me to speak some of those things. What I'd like to do just from this point, rather than structure things anymore, often in voicecraft sessions, we just open it to the silence. And so we can just be with the silence now, and whoever would like to speak into it, please go ahead. And I'm curious really to be with the pulse of, in many respects, the tension of how we relate with the predicament of this moment, of this context. And it always seems to me somehow that there's a kind of deep philosophical clarification that can come through that endeavor. And that would seem to be a really worthwhile thing to engage in the context of what we're doing here. So I'll just leave that open to the silence, and thank you both.
Well, I think I can, you know, just offer my initial reflections on on what's been expressed so far, and maybe offer a framing of let's say, why am I not working for some sort of I don't know, evolutionary think tank, or you know what why am I not continuing to go in this direction of studying this new evolution, let's say. And I think a lot of it has to do with really the ideological speciation event that Carl's talking about. You know, this ideological speciation event, you know, let's say that there's humanism, post-humanism, transhumanism, metahumanism, hyperhumanism. There's probably other distinctions that people are using to make sense of the ontological confusion. And I guess what that brought to me in my own research and studies is the need to return to foundational philosophy. I basically, you know, again, studied the evolutionary angle, and I felt like at a certain moment I had exhausted my capacity to think what was happening through that evolutionary lens, and basically collapsed back into philosophy as well as psychoanalysis. And I could articulate sort of the connecting points between those two epistemologies in relationship to these evolutionary speciation events and what we might be able to think through with these distinctions. The first is that, of course, as I think you'll both be well aware, with starting Philosophy Portal, I kind of have used Hegel as the starting point theoretically for that project. And why is that? So the reason why is because there's a sort of logical transformation that occurs in Hegel's work from the ancient world's logic. So to put it in the simplest of possible terms, the transition that's occurring there is between Aristotle's notion of the human being and Hegel's notion of the human becoming. Basically, Hegel derives a logic of becoming. And this is in some sense to be situated within Hegel's own time. It's not that Hegel's more intelligent than Aristotle. It's not that Hegel's more intelligent than Plato. He always refers to these figures with the utmost care and respect. It's that Hegel's living in some sense, a different time. A new transition, a new meta system in my language, had emerged in Hegel's time and had made clear that another form of becoming was at work, that ruptured the nation, that ruptured the notion of what we assume to be human being to its core. In some sense, the logic is a move from a substantive identity of a being to the contradiction of our being. And here, what Hegel's really taking in is the human being's relationship and confrontation with death as generative and positive of something new. So you could already see with this move of human becoming, basically, to put it in the logical formalisms, it's basically the human becoming contains being and nothing. The human becoming contains both being and nothing. You could say the human becoming contains both life and death. And thinking about that as where creativity and our becoming others is actually being derived, which, as a side note, is one of the reasons why I like Carl's notion of hyperhumanism, because it seems to me like he's not making, I think, the categorical error of, I think, some of the transhumanists who I think are working implicitly with Aristotle's logic, in the sense of that they're not really including death in the motor of change, but rather thinking that they can efface death entirely. And I think that's literally a philosophical error there. So like we can also make sort of distinctions in terms of what ideological speciation events might be taking a wrong turn. Right, like they might be going down the an actually ontologically wrong evolutionary rabbit hole, because they're working with a flawed logic, or they're working with the wrong presuppositions. Now, just to give some concrete examples of this transition from human being to human becoming, as well as its philosophical consequences, is that increasingly and this is being forced onto us by artificial intelligence, when you ask what is a human being, the main things people will say is maybe language is what makes us a human being. Creativity is what makes us a human being. Thinking is what makes us human being. Culture is what makes us human being. Whatever people will come up with distinctions that make us human being. Artificial intelligence is increasingly challenging all of these presuppositions. And even the most famous sort of distinction that Kurzweil makes of passing the Turing test is basically a distinction of, by 2030s, we're not going to be able to tell if I'm an AI or if we're in the 2030s, you might not be able to tell if I'm a real human being or if I'm an AI. Like, we won't be able to tell the difference, because we'll have large language models that will be able to, for example, read all of my work and reproduce a narrative that's fit for a podcast. Right? An AI, a large language model, will just be able to scan all of the podcasts that Cadell's ever been on, scan all of the books that Cadell's written, and it will be able to appear, and you'll be able to plug it into a podcast, and it'll be able to reproduce something that basically sounds like Cadell. And even like to give like a comical example of how actual this is right now, we are currently right now in the first ever rap beef where artificial intelligence is disrupting the rap beef, because Drake, Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, they're all releasing diss tracks at each other. And people are also releasing AI diss tracks. And when the AI diss track comes out, there has to be clearances, but the teams behind these rappers have to affirm, no, this is an AI diss track. I didn't release that diss track. Right? Like, it's literally, you can't tell, like, was that really Drake? No. So this is like literally an actual, it's, and Kurzweil, I think we should, like, Kurzweil says a lot of things that I think are technologically precise. So like, for example, he says, when it comes to the Turing test, that the Turing test won't just be passed in one day, like, oh, now we've passed the Turing test. He says it will happen over a period of a few years, where at first there'll be some sort of technology models where you can't really tell, or you can tell quite easily. And then over a period of years, after a period of years has passed, all of a sudden we'll be in a situation where we can't tell the difference anymore. And I think that is how it will happen. But the point here with the nature of going from human being to human becoming is that with a human becoming, the human being is not linked to any definite proposition. In other words, what a human being is not linked to whether it's language, creativity, culture, thinking. What the human being is not linked to a definite proposition that makes us human. The human becoming, and this is where I would transition into sort of Nietzsche's philosophy, the human becoming, is nothing but an overcoming of itself. And that's what Nietzsche is saying, that the human being is something that's constantly overcoming itself. And that's the only way we can tell what a human being is. It's this process of overcoming itself. And probably to link it then back to Hegel, is that this process of overcoming itself is our space of freedom. And the question here for philosophy, I think, and this is the, and then I'll stop, like the question for philosophy is, the historicity of our freedom. In every different historical mode of the human being, we have a space of freedom. We don't have absolute freedom in the sense we can just do whatever we like. That's what the transhumanists are fantasizing about. The transhumanists are fantasizing about a pure possibility space in which anything could happen and I could do anything and I'm omnipotent. Basically, they have a God fantasy. The real philosophical question is, what is the space of our freedom today? That's the zero level question for me. What is the space of our freedom today? And this is where I will link to my affinity for Carl's project and hyperhumanism, because I think that in the large evolutionary shift of these transitions that I'm talking about, is that we're basically trying to replace nature with technology. And in that process, reduce friction, difficulty, failure, and struggle to its minimum. So that we have no friction, so that we have no difficulty, so that we have no failure, so that we have no struggle. And here, nature in our history obviously introduced so much friction and difficulty and failure and struggle that we didn't need to worry about the problem of we didn't need to worry about the problem of introducing more friction or introducing more difficulty. It was already introduced by nature just fine. So now with the new technological background, this is where the Hyperhuman Project comes. And this is where I think Carl's saying, like giving reference to, like, for example, the Sherpas of the past as beings who have been through a lot of difficulty and have come out with a higher potential than someone who's just in a frictionless environment. The real point of hyperhumanism for me is that we need to actively introduce friction. We need to actively introduce difficulty. We need to actively introduce failure to resist both the technological environment's possibility to reduce us to our narcissism and to really open up a new possibility space and really explore the mega historical question, what is our freedom today?
Yeah, that's really good, Cadell. I mean, I'll just comment something really quick here. So when it comes to LLMs, it seems like LLMs will very soon get to the point, as you're saying, where they can recapitulate whatever philosophical theory you like. But they cannot, from my perspective, and I think it's fairly clear, they are not engaging in the praxis of philosophy. When you speak to overcoming in that Nietzschean sense, we're very much speaking about something profoundly relational in that sense of, talk about life-death process, what it is to meet death, what it is to participate in transformation, what it is to show up to life in the real, to really metabolize, to participate in that mode of praxis. Yeah. And the point I just like to make in relation to that is, I think it's important to take the perspective of hyperhumanism with respect to our attitude towards technology. But I think it's important to remember that, whether in the mode of philosophy or however we want to articulate in this case, the meaning of praxis, real participation, that struggle, we remain in already, from my perspective, in a deep continuity with that process. There's something of the grit and the rawness of life and death, which we've known only too well. And I think your points, Cadell, in relation around that we, in terms of the meta system at the level of technoculture, that propagation, maybe creativity or transcendence might find more of a form in the propagation of memes, or that, let's say, the embodiment of transcendence at a more noospheric level or something like this, rather than having children. I think that's super interesting, recognizing the ways in which death is showing up differently for us in that regard, and the creative process is showing up differently for us in that regard. I don't want to forget that or reduce that. I think that's extremely important. And yet, nevertheless, I would still contend that for the hyperhuman itself to remain in some coherent calibration, we could say grounding, we could say just continuity of design or support or ennoblement or encouragement or care for this value and you pointing to it in the kind of the spirit of the question of the your exact phrasing, Cadell, in terms of thinking the reality of or the possibilities for our freedom now, something like this, that to me seems very much a relation with, you could talk about that perhaps through the lens of a relation with the question, what can we be an influence with? The nature of influence itself, what is it to realize our influence today? What is it to choose? What is it to struggle with that process? It still seems to me that like that view of deep time, that reconnection with the deep time, as a like a phenomenological opening, much better way to say this, that at least has to be involved in this process of discovery and creating the future. We can go back and forth a few times if that's not coming through clearly. No doubt that will need to be said again. But I'm curious how you're relating with this, Carl, unless, Cadell, you feel the need to respond.
Well, I just want to say one thing before I let Carl jump in regards to the distinction you're making with the large language models and philosophy, because I just had a conversation yesterday with someone who's exploring this field. I think you know her, Carl. Her name's Naomi Roth. So I was just discussing with Naomi yesterday something that I think was super insightful in regards to the distinction we need to make with these large language models, which is in line with what you were saying about philosophy. These large language models will be able to reproduce sort of whatever philosophy, but they won't be involved in the struggle to do philosophy as such. And the distinction she was making is this, because she's studying people who are developing intimate relationships with artificial intelligence. The fascinating thing I learned from her was these artificial intelligence bots can reproduce most of what goes on in an intimate partner relationship dialogically. But what it can't do is reproduce the intimate partner conflicts. It can't reproduce the fights. It can't reproduce the struggle of the intimate partner relationship. So again, this is sort of the hyper-humanist point. The hyper-humanist point is actually the reason why we need to say the value of committing to a long-term relationship with an actual other human being is not for the romantic union and the person just mirroring you back to yourself. The point of being in a long-term relationship and the value of that is because it's friggin' difficult and it's the struggle and you're not going to understand each other. And there's just these conflicts that come up where you can actually learn about yourself in a way that you'd never be able to learn about yourself otherwise. So I just wanted to make.
Yeah, thanks, Cadell. Such poetry coming out of you today. Really appreciate everything you're saying, and a big fan of Naomi as well. I think what I'm picking up on a lot of this is that there are these fixed inbuilt mechanisms that we are designed through and by. And I'm really grateful for them. And I think that even if you look at the attempts to solve the longevity problem, I mean, people spending billions trying to sort of like become immortal, it's not working. It seems to just not work. And long may that continue. I think that it's a privilege to get older. It's a privilege to. I think there is a link. I mean, I talk about, you know, maybe not you're not aged 80, but you're at level 80. I think obviously we get more insight as we get older, and it's ironic that we have less energy. So it's this time energy problem again, as Dave talks about from Theory Underground. It's that we have to strive even harder as we get older to maintain what we have, because we intellectually we may be getting far greater insights, but yet your body's atrophying. And I think that that's the first sort of inbuilt mechanism that we're here to deal with. And then you've got this whole question that Cadell's talked about. Comfort kills what the lack of comfort creates, you know, and it's really a beautiful thing that we have to strive, that if you're very wealthy, you're generally miserable as hell. There seems to be a direct correlation between wealth and misery, and it's not something to strive for, I think, to have you know, it's like the squirrel just having an abundance of nuts, but then can't eat them or can't or can never. You can't have two lunches. I think that's the message, and that's the message that we hear loud and clear from the mycelium that have this entirely different and to be able to witness that. And I think if we can use technology to, maybe it'll be just, and I'm actually working on a project called the Wood Wide Web, where, you know, you're wearing glasses and then you can just look underneath. Everywhere you walk is this intelligence. So I think that what the transhumanists are doing is creating Wally's world. They're creating this paradox of choice, is, you know, that you have so much choice that you don't know what to do. You're paralyzed. So I think this possibility space needs to be constrained in order for you to really thrive. You know, it's like the best musicians, some of the richer musicians will buy all the equipment, but yet their work is nowhere near as good as somebody that's only got one piece of equipment that they really know how to use really, really well. And they become a master at that one thing. So I think that, you know, the other inbuilt mechanism is that we learn more through our mistakes than our successes, you know. And then you see people like David Pearce talk about paradise engineering, that all we need to focus on is bliss, but our potential for experiencing pleasure is massively smaller than our potential to experience pain. And I think that's because we benefit more through our struggle, through our striving. And this whole idea of owning things, you know, I mean, I've got a massive record collection, and it's around 10,000 strong in terms of vinyls. But it's interesting having a collection of anything of 10,000 items, because then you start to question, my God, I'm only here for 30,000 days. And this brings me onto my work with Cadell. So I'm writing a chapter about in the new anthology that Cadell's publishing, on my journaling practice, which turns out to be a quite a Hegelian process of this feedback loop. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing to journal, and I don't know how, I really recommend all your listeners to journal, but maybe not just journal about, you know, when you're happy, but also journal when you're miserable. Make sure you don't, you know. You know, I think that people on antidepressants, for instance, are in a really unfortunate position because they can't experience the extremes anymore. They can only experience this sort of very shallow, middle of the road, you know, and, you know, you can't even orgasm, apparently, on antidepressants. And that doesn't surprise me. So I think that what we need to be doing is creating these feedback loops, and journaling is a great way of creating this feedback loop, where you force yourself to live, you force yourself to have new material. So I write my journal from three levels, three in these structured ways. So I write content, what I did, context, what I felt, and concepts, what I thought. So it's the doing, it's the feeling, it's the thinking. These different structures are also captured in different ways, in different modalities. So the thinking is always handwritten, because I think that there's something about, again, this comes to the hyperhuman, we need to not lose the art of handwriting, because it's the embodiment of your ideation. It's the embodiment of your thinking. The context is all captured through my photography and my, you know, my videoing of things. And then my content's just a massive Word document. There's a digital database of everything I've ever done. And I've literally written my entire life, 36 years now of writing. So I started when I was 15. And it's an incredible tool. And people have always tried to push me to say, don't do it. This is dangerous. You're going to outsource your memory. But then I point to them. I point to the advantages that I have. I have this superpower of being able to jump out of point of view and go into field of view. And we talked about relationships and how important it is to be in relation, and whether that's in relation with community or relation with a partner, it's the ultimate project. The thing that you're going to remember on your deathbed is not your work, it's your relationships. And I think that there they house the real work. And I notice when I'm in relationship, because my mirror enables me to have much more reflective shine, as Hegel talks about it, that I'm able to really dive into this reflection because I have a mirror. And I think when you're in community, you have these mirrors where you can't just go off and disassociate, and that's going to work. People won't let you. They're there to sort of hold you and to make sure that you're like, be, you know, fulfilling your potential, doing the best you can. And I think that that's the thing. I am both of you, both of us, and so are you. You know, it's that non-dual approach. And I think that the journaling practice, you know, when I'm in a relationship, say I've been in a relationship for a year, I can read that entire relationship in an afternoon. And it's a fascinating thing to get this bird's eye view, to turn that landscape into a land, that relationship into a landscape where I'm able to see patterns emerge, where I'm able to see these mistakes being made over and over again. And I think it also shows you that you're not in a linear progress like the transhumans want to believe, that we're just continuously striving. No, we're in a spiral, and we continuously go through this spiral, repeating history, and in this cyclical nature, going back to the same problems over and over again until we resolve them. And I think that that's a beautiful thing as well, that there's no linear progress, and that we should embrace the fact that we are in a death spiral, that death is essential for us to be regenerative, for us to have any kind of impetus to get anything done. And I think that that's what drives me. It's this idea that it's a privilege to die. And I've even had warnings about turning my diary, which is the perfect data set, if you think about it, for an AI, because I've got all of those conceptual layers. So it's, but I've been warned off it in a full-on lucid dream, which lasted 8 hours, where I was basically shown, if you create this sentience, if you actually do create this version of yourself, that version won't be able to die. And that was horrific, because I think death may well be a huge expansion of consciousness, and we may not know when, you know, nobody comes back to tell us, but that's for a reason. I think that there's a secret in death, and I'm with my work with the psychedelic realms. You know, when I go into Imperial College and I have my brain scanned whilst being injected with DMT, what we can see from those scans is that I'm dreaming, that I'm in a dreamlike state. And when I go into the Great Pyramid, and we hire the pyramid every year, when we do our brain scans in there, we're asleep whilst awake. We're in a lucid dream. We're dreaming. You know, so what is this golden thread between the psychedelics, the sacred sites? How do these sacred sites put us into this liminal state? Why is it that when we're wanting to really be creative, we sleep on it? We have a problem, we go to bed and we sleep on it. I've got my notebook ready for when I wake up, because I'm scrambling to get the ideas down, because they're delivered to me in that dreamlike state. And when you're asleep, your brain's actually more active than when you're awake. So maybe what we're doing here in this dream is we are just, maybe the real life is in the dreamlike space, and all we do in life is just exhaust ourselves to go to sleep, to have our real experience. And then the death, I think the death is mirrored there in this dreaming, that maybe death isn't what we think it is. Maybe death is, in my experience, and I've had a life review, I've had these insights in a near-death experience, where actually what you get in the death state is very similar to what I get in my journaling practice, which is this ability to go into other things. So in my journaling, I'm really able to analyze, and I'm really able to go back into things in a way that I don't have time in the moment. Everyone talks about being in the moment as if there's no advantage to not being in the moment, but I think there's plenty of advantages. And in the death state, my insight is that if you've done harm to somebody, you will in the death state be them and you at the same time in this double consciousness. And therefore there is no escape. You know, we are in a learning gym. We are in I was going to say simulation. We are in this space, and I don't think it is a simulation. I think it's very organic. I think it's extremely valuable, and everything we do here, we reflect upon, I think, in the death space. Maybe it is just in the 40 days You know, in the Bardo, as the Tibetans tell us in their thinking on this. But I think that there's a lot to be said about learning to die before you die. This seems to be an art. And I think that dreaming and dream yoga, the practice of having lucid dreams, the practice of having nested dreams, when you fall asleep inside a dream and you wake up inside the dream, but you're still asleep. You know, and people talk about having multiple nested layers in this kind of inception. And they're the masters, the people that are training in their dreams. I know people that do Tai Chi in their dreams. But in order to really do Tai Chi in your dream, the first time you'll try it, you'll float off the ground because you haven't installed gravity. So this is the true context engineering where you have to create the entire environment. This is why dreamlike states are very much about the hyperhuman. And there are now technologies that are the transhuman version of dreaming, where you can wear a device called, there's something called Halo that's coming out, which will give you the ability to have lucid dreams because it's transcranial stimulation. It's the typical Western, let's just go in there with full brute force, use electricity to override the work that we actually need to do. And it comes back to what Cadell was saying, we need to build friction back in. We need to do the work to get to the point where we are learning how to dream before we die, because these are the real spaces where we practice our humanity.
I mean, I want to make just a few distinctions that I think would help us make an Iron Man argument for the distinction between transhumanism and hyperhumanism, so that we're not strawmanning something that doesn't exist. The first is, I just want to make two distinctions. The first is that I don't think the transhumanists are thinking in a linear way. That's the first. So I want to say how the transhumanists are thinking. So to me, they go from the circle to the line, right? So the circle would be like organic life. It just repeats generation after generation after generation, life and death, a circle. The circle of life, the circle of life that just goes on forever. Then you have a line with a beginning and an end, and that would be our recognition that we die. Like, and you could even say in relationship to other, like, for example, it's a fascinating topic, a primatological study of death, like about how chimpanzees react to death. Like they do react to death. But it's not, they don't bury their dead. They don't have a reflective process of relating to death in a social community in the way that obviously humans do. Now, we can go down that rabbit hole, but I just want to make that distinction. The zero level signifier for the transhumanist is the exponential. That the linear goes to the exponential. And the exponential is like this line that curves. So like we can even think about this in regards to like general relativity in physics. There's this line that curves into infinity. And then the mystery is what happens at infinity, right? Just in the same way that in general relativity, like what happens beyond the event horizon of a black hole? What happens in a black hole? Like what's going on there? This is still sort of a philosophical mystery. So I just want to say that there's this circle to the line to the exponential, which the transhumanists are pointing towards. And then the second distinction is, it seems to me, the main difference between transhumanism and hyperhumanism is that the transhumanists claim that the ultimate overcoming is the overcoming of death. And the hyperhumanists would say that the ultimate overcoming is inclusive of death. So it's whether or not we exclude or we include death. And what's the right path there? Do we include it? Do we exclude it? And then one point, maybe interesting, but it's kind of a theological point that I've been playing with, which is related to what Carl's talking about of learning to die before you die. And what is involved with learning to die before you die? Because I don't know about you guys, but in my personal reflections on death, I'm actually not too concerned about the afterlife, like whether or not I live on in the afterlife. Like that doesn't emotionally concern me too much. I don't seem, my thought naturally doesn't seem to care too much.
I share that.
What really concerns me and what really feels bad is to be excluded from something socially. Like either to be excluded from something socially is like a social death, or to exclude someone socially. Like when I can't include someone, right? I experience that as painful. But there's this point, and I think this is the theological point, that I think theologically, I don't know if people are too concerned about whether or not they, whatever, the metaphysics about the fate of your soul after you die. It's more, it seems to me, especially when you study denominational conflicts between different religious groups, it seems to all be about whether or not I'm included in the right social group. Like, am I included in the Protestant group? Am I included in the Catholic group? Am I included in the Orthodox group? Or am I excluded from these groups? Or in just social, or if you just think about in romantic social life, being rejected from someone, being or having to reject someone. That this, to me, the crucial distinction there is to learn to die before you die means being able to withstand social death, meaning social betrayal, violence, being excluded from something you would like to be included in, or excluding someone that you can't include. And I wonder if that is the hyperhumanist path. The hyperhumanist path is being able to die before you die in a way that you can navigate these social tensions in a higher order way than humans have before. Because clearly these tensions are what where I think people spend most of their mental energy in negative spirals about this process.
Yeah, I think that's really good. There's something about referencing it there as a kind of the social exclusion can happen upon our death, and I think that's a really productive movement to recognize that we can cultivate, and indeed really must cultivate, a capacity to relate with the including and excluding dynamics of human culture, the transformations of relationship. It's part of maturation in some critical sense as well. Can no longer be included in your high school year 12 class because now you're a year older and that's for a different group. Okay, you got to move on. So there's something very much in the notion of maturation there, which I think rings very true. On the transhumanist perspective, to I think speak to that appropriately, I'm kind of making a link there between that same thought you're expressing and that fascination and almost, I will use the language of fetish, with the event horizon. Now, past that event horizon, it's not a belief in, as I see it playing out, there's it's not an ambivalence about the event horizon. It's a pretty definitively held view that there's a good here. That's a good idea, right? It's a question for humanity. We want to go that way, okay? And there's a certain, in that space, there's this kind of, in my opinion, again, I don't think it's a straw man, but a kind of a naive attitude towards the fulfillment of all possible relation. You could look at it like that. You can have any experience you like, essentially, right? You can be everywhere, you know, do everything. You mentioning in terms of the participating in the omniscient and something like that, the omnipotent and these types of things. And I think Carl's very much right to sort of point out the lack of, let's say, struggle, suffering in relation there, and what can be lost. And you brought up Cadell as well, the significant, like the LLMs not being able to reproduce the struggle in that regard, the real contact, really, like the critic, like it's crucial for the contact of being in relation as such. So the very notion of coherence itself becomes lost. And in that movement towards a singularity, there's not only is there a fetish with what I just described, but there's like in that movement, there's a dissociation from remaining in contact with essentially like the mode of affirmation of life. We could talk about it through the lens of lack. I think is super important, really, the language of lack to really address this properly. That dying before you die, in this sense, almost, you know, maybe too simplified, becomes the other side of the coin, is just the affirmation of life. An image that really has really borne me along like a dream in my own life is an image of myself at an older age, taking a step out the door of a beautiful home, and inside I see lots of people and they're engaging and they're in a sense familial, but it's certainly communal. And there's vitality there. There's different ages and people, and there's vitality. And that vitality is so totally happening without my presence in it. I've just left. Now, maybe I leave the door ajar because I'm off to the cliff to sit. And maybe it's my time to leave. But there's something about the in a sense, like the real appreciation for what is, like to really appreciate what is, does become a relation with that greater than. When Carl's saying this, I am both of us and so are you, part of at least how I relate to that phenomenologically and in the experience I've had of what it is to meet death again, there's a way of relating with that that can also be phrased not just through the kind of the grittiness of struggle. I think that's super critical, right? But there's also a grace. There's also a grace to be with tension. Struggle's a way of being with tension. There's a graceful way of being with tension. And that in terms of this question of freedom, what is it there to be free with? I'm not going to cram all this into the mode of conversation as something which I think can actually stimulate the kind of, now as a, not without being, having done the studies or calling myself a scientist, I'm not going to claim that certain modes of interaction, communication, conversation can elicit the same states as certain kinds of dreaming. But I would speculate that there's a lot of, through the meeting of a depth of real transformative exchange, being open to real relation with the question, really showing up to the process of understanding, really listening. You know, you can imagine, what is it? I mean, I don't want to necessarily use the example of a guru here. Just take any old teacher, of course, guru meaning that, but we have a lot of other baggage associated. Sometimes when you encounter someone, people hear someone speak and they get totally enraptured by it. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the right way to listen, but to a certain degree, giving oneself over to that kind of understanding, the images painted, the mind, the worldview, the possibility, the potential that's depicted in that communication, in that expression, what that affords the perception of the listener is profoundly transformative, can be profoundly transformative. You could look at that as a kind of death, because all of a sudden now I was on this one track and now I'm no longer recognizable to myself because I've been opened up to a way of seeing, and that way of seeing now and my attitude, how I can expand into that space, that's just a different being now. It's a different being. But it's now, what is it to really enter exchange, like ethically, appropriately, right? Now I will come back to arguing for a certain, the participation in the craft of that understanding, in the communication, so as to remain in some critical degree participating in the transformation, not just being borne along by it, not being whisked away into some, you know, utterly unknown at the behest of someone who might be more on the side of manipulating that context. And in a way, you can kind of see the whole promise of singularity and this becoming something so totally other as sort of that. Yeah, just, you know, just give us all your money and, you know, maybe we'll build some machines you can upload / kill yourself into and have a great time. It sounds so ridiculous, right? It's so ridiculous. But that's kind of analogical to the, you know, guru running off with your wife, so to speak, or something like this, just giving oneself over to the kind of construction, the intellectual construction that actually is not being offered or proffered as something to really wrestle with, to actually relate with and touch in that way. And so there's much more we can both, I'm losing a bit of the grace element there, but I think this is partly where you know, in the context of hyperhumanism and the kind of technologies that can be developed, and that, and I love, like, Carl, your term of contextology. The promise of contextology for me is one which takes critical care for the support for the integrity of communication. What, and there's nothing more radical than communication, nothing more radical than real meeting for exchange. So I said a lot of things there, but that was some things really came together in what you both expressed.
Let me say one thing.
Yeah. As we move in, we've got about 15 minutes or so, and so why don't we open up then just with some intention towards closing expressions, given that you do have a hard stop, Carl. And
let me just come back on this particular topic. I think Cadell's raised an interesting point here about social exclusion. If you haven't heard the term Tescriel, then you should know about it. But it's this seven ideologies, so it's an acronym. I'm not going to go through all of them, but there's two parts to it that are interesting to this question, which is effective altruism and long-termism. So effective altruism is this idea that we should be using our resources to do the most good for the most people. And a while ago, that was mosquito nets, so that we should all put money into mosquito nets because that was killing the most people. Now it's this idea of creating real AI. And then long-termism is this belief that we should focus on the long-term future rather than the short-term. So even if you combine those two things, and Bostrom's really at the heart of a lot of this thinking, and he's being used as a bit of an excuse by these big tech companies and people like Musk to really just get us to Mars and create AI. And it doesn't matter what happens to humans. So I think this idea of social exclusion, we as humans are being excluded from this challenge, from this vision of the future. And I think that that's the danger, right? We are giving up our humanity. We're giving up our poetry. We're giving up our artistic abilities and letting the machine do that. And frankly, why? Why would we want to have a future where there is no legacy for the human project, that all of the internet becomes generative AI, that all of the music that's created is not made by us, that all of the poetry that is created is not made by us, or rather it is made by us, but secondhand. So going back to Jimi Hendrix, are you experienced? You know, will we no longer have firsthand experience? Will we just live in secondhand experience, which is not living at all? I think this is the point, you know, that, and Terence McKenna talked about this idea of make your own culture. Don't live inside the existing culture. Make your own culture, live inside it. And I think that that's the exclusion. We're being excluded from creating our own legacies, our own cultures. And, you know, we're already seeing some limits here. And this is an interesting one, that there's already a form of cannibalism occurring, because if AI starts to eat itself, and it is, because there's a certain amount of the internet now which is generative AI, you're seeing thousands of YouTube channels being created that are very little to do with humans. You know, they're just literally content made mainly to make some revenue. But the danger of that is that, or rather it's not a danger, it's a win for humans, is that when AI starts to eat itself, when it starts to, if your language learning model is based around the internet and the internet is the model that you're training it on, then it starts to hallucinate when it eats its own content. And therefore, there is a real need for human fresh creativity for AI to flourish. So it is this symbiotic relationship that needs to be maintained. In order for AI to develop, it needs humans, because it is based on all of human culture after all. So I think that's a big message that we need to sing and dance about in order to counter what Gerard Larnier is talking about. It's not the AI that's the problem, it's the way we perceive it. And we will go mad from thinking that we have no place, that we are cancelled as humanity. And I think that it's echoed in things like the hikikomori, right? I mean, in Japan, I was there in 2015, 500,000 young Japanese men already excluding themselves from society because they just deem it too hard. And now all of us are experiencing that sensation of, should I become hikikomori? Should I retreat to the cave? Because it's become too hard for all of us. And that's because the cost of living is going straight through the roof, and your wages aren't echoing that. So nobody can afford anything anymore. You know, even being a tenured professor, I still don't have enough money to save any money. So how the hell does anyone else survive? So it's that idea that we need to context engineer, we need ontological design, we need to create a new economy where we focus on our subjectivity, where we focus on what we can do as humans, what will not be replaceable. And it's not all about intelligence. There's plenty of things, as Cadell says, it's the fights, it's the stuff that's the nitty gritty, it's the very humanness that will never be replaced, which I think is a brilliant message for hyperhumanism.
Fantastic. So just building off of what Carl's saying, because I think a lot of what Carl's saying there, especially in his closing one, is really generative for the future of thinking on this topic. So the first thing is that we should not exclude from our analysis of transhumanism the socioeconomic and sociopolitical, or the political economic dimension of the conversation, and specifically that all of this technology is being generated within the horizon of neoliberal capitalism, and that when we bring into the equation Marxist theory, what we are bringing into the equation is class difference and class conflict. And precisely when Carl's talking about social exclusion on the level of building colonies on Mars, or even billionaires building bunkers on islands away from the main human body, this is a symptom of neoliberal capitalism, where the hyper-rich are, in some sense, running away from the problem of social exclusion, which is the real, I think, dying before you die, which is really recognizing that you are a part of the whole human body. You are a part of the whole of human civilization. You cannot separate yourself off, scission yourself off from this project and upload yourself into a machine interface or something like that. So just thinking about tech, what is the interconnection? This is my theoretical or philosophical question for Carl. What is the interconnection between hyperhumanism and political economy? How can we bring hyperhumanism into a generative conversation with technology beyond neoliberal capitalism, and specifically technology in a socialist context, or technology in a paradigm beyond the capitalist paradigm, or at least sublating the capitalist paradigm? The second point that I want to make in relationship to Carl's notion of AI cannibalism is really an important point, because it allows me to bring in the connection to psychoanalysis that I wanted to bring in earlier, which is that it makes a lot of sense that if the transhumanist visions are disembodied visions, if these are really disembodied visions, which they seem to be, that these visions end in a cannibalistic sort of process, meaning that they sort of they are basically foreclosing the dimension of the unconscious body, on the level of eating, fucking, killing, and they end up eating the other. They end up, you basically see that the vision of the disembodied state is actually an incestuous fantasy. And it's wanting to be with the other, where you cannot be excluded. And of course, the primal exclusion, socially speaking, is just the infant with the mother, right? You're being you cannot have the mother. You have to grow up, right? So this is really important. And then the final point I'll make is that what's coming up in, I think, a lot of artificial intelligence philosophy today, and the person who I've interacted with personally on this topic is Isabel Millar, in her book the psychoanalysis of artificial intelligence, is we have to think about the drive body and artificial intelligence. In other words, we have to continue to think through the future of technology, but inclusive of the body, inclusive of specifically the drive body. And the question that Isabel Millar raises here is not, does it think, but rather, does it enjoy? In other words, these machines might be able to simulate thinking, but if it excludes the body, it's excluding enjoyment. It's excluding this dimension. So this is one of the things that I think is an important philosophical point. And that finally, just to conclude, that if we apply psychoanalysis to these tech visions, basically, to my mind, what it brings us to is this structure, which is well identified in psychoanalysis, that our starting condition as humans is the impotent body. We are born impotent. And the danger for the ego is to fantasize of a body that's omnipotent, right? The exact opposite of our starting condition, right? So unless we psychoanalyze the very body within which our minds develop, we run the risk of developing these fantasies, which are totally disconnected from any meaningful engagement with the human civilizational body as such. And then I guess the final point is the difference between just affirming life. And I agree with you, Tim, we have to affirm life. But the difference between just affirming life and including within that affirmation of life dying before you die is that if you just affirm life, I think what you risk is not knowing what to do with the pain of your own impotence, right? Because if you just like, and so like, for example, when you're a teenager, you just affirm life. Oftentimes you get rejected or you get, you know, something negative happens and you don't know what to do with that negative affect. So I think including within the affirmation of life dying before you die allows you to affirm life inclusive of your own impotence. And I think that's what's crucial. And perhaps because if you think the transhumanists would say, I'm affirming life, because they're saying I'm affirming immortality. I'm the real one who's affirming life because I'm affirming immortality. So you can't get more affirmation of life than that. But in fact, it's because they're not including within the dying before they die, that actually their affirmation of life is a fake in some sense. So I'll end there.
Yeah, point well made, and I agree with you. I think a way that I would frame this is, the way I try to it's interesting. I try to speak. It's not try to speak. I mean, to the degree that I'm in integrity, I'm speaking. I'm crafting voice. I'm speaking from a mode that, in expressing an affirmation of life, it's coming through that process. And so you can kind of differentiate between that kind of a pre-tragic and then a post-tragic way to affirm life, and basically what you've done in terms of that dying before you die element in relation with impotence, and in that sense having met disaster, having met inadequacy, having engaged with lack, all these types of things. This is canonical of what we could speak about as an element of the transition between the pre-tragic, tragic, and post-tragic, is precisely that metabolization of suffering, inadequacy, impotence, all of these types of things. So I'm here and with you, and it's important to clarify, but then it matters who you're speaking to in terms of what becomes relevant to express. The point that I would make just in closing is a kind of building on what you've each shared here. So I'm actually going to read. It'd be a better way to give a preamble to this. But I'm going to read a very short sentence by a man named Brian Johnson, who I think it's fair to say is a high priest of transhumanism at the moment. I'll include some links to where you can hear him speak. Describes himself as the world's most measured human, which is apt. The sentence is this: when I pose a question to myself, do I want to live or want this or that? I don't trust what I have to say, ever. That's what he said, and he means that, right? And I think there is something very transhuman about that. I think in that there is a kind of an abdication. It's an expression of that abdication, of that real inquiry, that real wrestle with all those elements you're mentioning, Cadell. Of course, we can speak about the various ways that we delude ourselves and speak about it through the lens of cognitive science. But the whole history of philosophy, in some critical sense of what it is to really inquire with the question of who are we, what are we doing here, what is the nature of things, right? And so for me, like where I see like a hope for the hyperhuman, perhaps in the context of what Cadell's inquiring as well, in terms of the economic and the political, we'd have to build a few more things out. But I mentioned communication before. But I think the movement towards supporting the cultivation of trust in communication is deeply hyperhuman. Because I think in this loss of complete breakdown, it's immediately self-effacing and contradictory to just say, I don't trust what I have to say ever. There's already built into that a meaning of trust. There's built into that epistemology. There's built into that a sense of needing to measure and what computation can tell me about myself, which is going to be that source of trust. And so I think we have to contend with the predicament a lot of this, like as much as the hyperhuman looks to technology and how we meet the future in that regard, in dedication to life, let's say, and human beings and the possibility for humanity. But there's also something so fundamental just in that movement of know thyself. And you can approach that through psychoanalysis or various ways. But the meaning of that's been here with us for a very long time. And so, you know, for me, engaging in philosophy in the mode of praxis and the cultivation of real relationship, I mean, these are things which are of the essence of value, and they're not displaced at all by artificial intelligence. They might be dislodged. You could say this or that, Lisa, but in terms of there's always that value to recover. I mean, it's just what happens when you show up to what is. There's always a question there. There's always a question. There's always a, how am I relating? What is there to do? What is there to accept? What is there to challenge, you know? And onwards we go. What is there to create? So we have to bring it to a close now. I've really enjoyed this. Hope we can run it back.
Can I jump in just, Tim, just with one comment, sort of closing comment? I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I think both Cadell and I have really gone into transhumanism, maybe started from transhumanism. And yeah, it's great to see that we can reveal the flaws. I think another flaw that hasn't even been touched upon yet is this idea that, you know, a big trope of transhumanism is this idea of uploading your consciousness. And the big elephant in the room is we don't know what consciousness is. You know, it's really that simple. And the more we learn about consciousness, the less we know about it. And it's that whole thing, you know. So I think we're living as if we have the resources of six planets. So when we hear about, you know, the transhumanists saying that they're doing an honorable thing by living forever, when you're literally outstaying your welcome through this, you know, the biological limits and the resources limits. So I think it's absolutely our birthright to explore our consciousness, and let's explore it by being hyperhuman, by mapping out the technology, the techniques of hyperhumanism, the art of hyperhumanism, the politics, as Cadell, I'd love to have had more time to speak today, but yeah, I think Cadell and I really, you know, we need to talk way more about the politics of hyperhumanism, the science of hyperhumanism, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's a North Star. It's something that's endless. And you know, I think that it's something that I'm dedicated to continuing.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, let's run it back and bring it to an end here. Thank you both.